It's now 2:30, so I make a start to this second issue-specific hearing. I welcome you all, ladies and gentlemen, to this Port Talbot Power Station project hearing. My name is Roger Eyre, and I am an examining inspector, and I have been appointed by the Secretary of State to be the single appointed person that is examining this application. First, please could I ask that you make sure your mobile phones are either set to silent or preferably turned off. And may I also introduce those members of the case team from the Planning Inspectorate who are here with me today. On my left is Tracy Williams, the case manager, and Steve Parker, case officer, is over there who's been handling the registration. We also have with us today Mel Bisher from the Consent Service Unit. She is not here in her official capacity. She's here purely to observe. Before getting down to business, I need to cover the procedures in case of an emergency. I am advised that there are no planned fire alarms today, so if one should sound, then please exit appropriately via the emergency exits, which are signposted through the double doors and through the corner over to my right, and then please congregate in the car park behind me in order that we can account for everybody. For your convenience, toilets are located just outside the double doors to my left. You're all very welcome, and I will ask you to introduce yourselves in a minute. You will see from the agenda that no breaks are scheduled. I may suggest a short break if necessary. An audio recording, which will be the only official record of this hearing, is being made, and this will be made available on the Port Talbot section of the National Infrastructure pages of the Planning Portal website. With this in mind, there are roving microphones, so if you could wait for one of these before you speak, and then if you could state your name, who you represent, if you are a representative, and then speak clearly into the microphone. Before asking you to introduce yourselves, can I inquire whether there are any journalists present this afternoon? No, thank you. Can I also inquire whether anybody intends to record, tweet, or film these proceedings for their own use? No, again, thank you very much. Please bear in mind that the only official record of the proceedings today is the PINS audio recording. Tweets, blogs, and similar communications arising out of this hearing will not be accepted as evidence in the examination of this application. Would those present now introduce themselves, please, and if you are a representative, who you represent? Could we start with the applicant, please?
Good afternoon, sir. My name's Duncan O'Connor from PINS St Mason's, who are solicitors for the applicant. And I'm joined by, on my right, Ben Lewis of GVA, who are the planning consultants, the applicant, Catherine Anderson from AECOM, environmental consultants, Guy Sims and Mohammed Jahandir of the applicant.
Thank you. Neath Port Talbot.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Steve Ball. I'm the development manager for planning for Neath Port Talbot Canterbury Council.
Joanna Stevens, solicitor, Neath Port Talbot Canterbury Council.
Paul Coleman, Planning Officer, Neath Port Talbot, County Borough Council.
Thank you. NRW?
Louise Edwards, NRW.
Gareth Lewis, NRW.
Thank you. ABP?
Sir, can I begin by introducing myself? Brian Greenwood, I'm partner and solicitor at Winkworth Sherwood, representing Association of British Ports. And there are three members of Associated British Ports here to assist you should you so require, sir. I'll leave them to introduce themselves.
Thank you, Brian. I'm Callum Cooper. I'm port manager for Associated British Ports at South Wales, with specific responsibility for Swansea, Port Talbot and Barry.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Slorak. I'm a civil engineer working for Associated British Ports.
Good afternoon, I'm Byron Lewis. I'm an estate surveyor from Associated British Ports.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak at this meeting, please? No? After these opening remarks, I will ask whether there are any requests to question a person making oral representations directly under Section 94 of the 2008 Planning Act. The purpose of the hearing, we are conducting this hearing in accordance with sections 91 and 94 of the Planning Act 2008 and the Infrastructure Planning Examination Procedure Rules 2010, specifically Rule 14 relating to procedure at hearings. You are reminded that Section 94(8) of the 2008 Act allows that the EXA may refuse to allow representations to be made at the hearing if the EXA considers that the representations are irrelevant, vexatious, or frivolous, relate to the merits of policy set out in a national policy statement, repeat other representations already made in any form and by any person, or relate to compensation for compulsory acquisition of land. Rule 14.2 requires that at the start of the hearing, the examining authority shall identify the matters to be considered at the hearing. The agenda for today's hearing was published on the Port Talbot Project website on the 1st of April, and I believe there may be further copies of today's hearing agenda at the registration point, should anybody not have one. We will follow this agenda today. Does everybody have a copy of the agenda? Fine, thank you very much. We've now dealt with the first two agenda items, so I'll move to agenda item 3, requests to question a person making oral representations directly under section 94 of the 2008 Act. After the examining authority has asked their own questions, there may, at the EXA's discretion, be an opportunity for those parties who wish to ask questions directly of another party to do so. Parties should assume that they will be allowed a maximum of 15 minutes for this. Does anyone wish to do this as distinct from simply addressing their own case? No. Thank you. We'll now move on to the main subject of this afternoon's meeting, agenda item 4, outstanding issues. Attendees will note that the agenda for this second issue-specific hearing is based on the EXA's second round of questions. It is my aspiration that this will allow me to be brought up to date on the latest situation regarding the outstanding issues in order that I may conclude this examination effectively and efficiently. Moving to the first section, 4.1 General, 4.1.1 Statements of Common Ground. Can the applicant provide evidence, either in the form of a signed and agreed SOCG or through written confirmation by the respective authority, that an SOCG is not considered necessary with each of the following, starting with Neith Port Talbot, please?
We are proposing to enter into a statement of common ground with Neath Port Talbot. A draft is in circulation, and we've received comments back from Neath Port Talbot on that draft recently, and we'll be going through those. The focus of attention has been on various matters that are set out in that statement of common ground, such as the design principles document and so on recently. We've made good progress with those. There are still a couple of outstanding issues, which I'm sure we'll mention in the course of this hearing, but we hope to be able to update the examining authority and, if possible, submit the agreed statement of common ground for deadline 6 next week.
Thank you. Swansea?
Discussions are continuing with them, and we're awaiting a response as to whether they consider a statement of common ground is required. It's still not clear from them.
Hopefully you'll be able to resolve that by deadline 6 as well.
Indeed, yeah, we'll update you next week, sir.
Thank you. Carmarthen?
Carmarthen have formally confirmed that they don't require a statement of common ground. We will submit evidence of that deadline 6.
Thank you. Powys?
Position is the same for Powys as for Carmarthen. We have formal confirmation that it's not required, and we'll submit that next week.
Thank you. Rhonda Cunnan-Taff?
They've agreed verbally that no statement of common ground is required. We've sought written confirmation from Rhonda on two occasions, and we're still awaiting a response from them. We'll do our best to get that for next week, and if so, we'll submit that for deadline 6.
Thank you. Bridgend?
Bridgend have formally confirmed a statement of common ground is not required. We'll submit evidence of that next week.
Thank you. Brecon Beacons National Park?
And the same applies for Brecon Beacons as well.
Thank you. The Coal Authority?
The Coal Authority have indicated that a requirement for a statement of common ground will depend on the results of the site investigation report. A final version of that report was submitted to the Coal Authority on the 13th of April. So they are currently reviewing that, and depending on whether they agree with its findings, they will indicate whether they want a statement of common ground. So again, we'll seek to update the examining authority.
Thank you.
Next week.
Thank you for that. Royal Mail Group?
To date, they've not indicated they want a statement of common ground. We've recently been in contact with Royal Mail Group to suggest how their concerns regarding construction traffic might be addressed through an amendment to the DCO. And Royal Mail Group have indicated that their advisors are taking instructions on that point and will revert to us, but at this stage they're not indicating that they require a statement of common ground.
But they may wish to have something in the DCO protecting their operations against potential construction traffic impacts.
Indeed, and if they are satisfied with the measures that we've proposed, and we'll try and get that confirmed next week, we will try and provide evidence of that between the parties next week. It may not take the form of a statement of common ground.
Thank you. And finally, Associated British Ports.
The progress so far has been to attempt to resolve the position between the parties through protective provisions. I'll be able to update you on those discussions. If that's possible, I think we consider a statement of common ground won't be necessary, and it will be dealt with through protective provisions and any other arrangements.
Okay. Thank you. Do any of the parties present involved in those statements of common ground wish to add anything? No? Thank you very much. Moving on then to item 4.2, compulsory acquisition.
I beg your pardon, sorry. I've been pointed out. I think I omitted NRW from that list, or they were omitted from that list, I think. But you have an agreed statement of common ground submitted, and we have now obtained a signed copy, which we will submit for deadline 6 next week. Apologies.
I acknowledge the agreed statement of common ground that was received prior to this hearing, and I'm thankful that you now confirm the written version will be submitted as evidence hereafter. Thank you very much. 4.2.1, agreements for acquisition of rights and protection of interests. Can the applicant and Network Rail please provide evidence to confirm the conclusion of agreements between the two parties covering the acquisition of rights and protection of interests?
The draft agreements are still in circulation between the parties. We had hoped to have those settled before today's hearing, but Network Rail indicated that they wouldn't be able to come back to us until later this week. There are relatively minor points outstanding, and we would expect to be able to settle those, if possible, before deadline 6 and update you accordingly. And we appreciate that until those agreements are signed off, Network Rail's objection remains.
Indeed. Network Rail are not present today, so I look forward to an update by deadline 6, hopefully. Thank you. Moving on then to 4.3, design access layout and visual. Can the applicant please confirm the status of the design principle statement to be drawn up in agreement with Neath Port Talbot, and whether this will be submitted to the EXA as evidence, and if so, when?
Yes, sir. I'm pleased to report that the design principles document has been agreed with Neath Port Talbot. A version of the agreed document will be submitted by deadline 6. And as you're aware, that document is linked to a requirement 4 of the DCO, which requires the detailed design that's submitted to Neath Port Talbot for approval to be in accordance with the design principles document.
Indeed. Thank you. Neath Port Talbot, you wish to add anything to that? Thank you. Moving on then to the DCO, a couple of issues here. The first to do with the revisions to Article 26, procedure in relation to certain approvals. I'm happy to read it all out if you wish me to, but I assume you're familiar with it, having had it published on the website. Please could you comment on the following revisions as to whether you are prepared to accept them or what action you propose to take?
The applicant's position at the moment is that it still considers that the bespoke mechanism for the discharge of requirements that's set out in Schedule 5 and which is applied by Article 26 is appropriate at this stage. The Council's proposals for Article 26 are seeking to apply the Town and Country Planning Act regime. At this stage, the applicant considers that that regime doesn't provide enough certainty, particularly in terms of the timescales for the discharge of requirements and any subsequent appeals relating to those determinations. Having said that, we are in discussions with Neath Port Talbot about an agreement which will help to provide greater certainty about the process by which the requirements of the DCO will be discharged. Those are ongoing, and in fact we're going to use the time this afternoon to meet with the council and talk through our proposals in that respect. Any update we make on that will be confirmed by deadline 6, and so that will include the applicant's preferred position in relation to Article 26 and Schedule 5. The applicant's rationale for applying Schedule 5 and the drafting of Article 6 were set out in response to the first round questions. And in summary, that was that this is a nationally significant infrastructure project, and we consider it's appropriate in the context of a streamlined regime that the position in relation to the discharge of requirements should be equally streamlined. Advice note 15, a PINS advice note 15 notes that it may be appropriate for the DCO to set out the procedures for the discharge of requirements, and that has been done in previous DCOs as we have submitted previously. Having said that, you know, subject to the outcome of the discussions with Neath Port Talbot, which we'll be using the time for this afternoon, it may be that we'll revisit Article 26 and Schedule 5 in the context of the overall arrangements that are agreed with the council.
Thank you. Neath Port Talbot, do you want to comment at this stage?
Only to say that the local planning authority would still requires the wording to provide for sections 78 and 79 of the Town and Country Planning Act at this stage. As the applicant has said, there were further discussions with regard to the PPA, hopefully this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. Moving on then to 242, Schedule 2, Requirement 4, regarding the maximum dimensions. In the applicant's document relating to the need for changes in the maximum dimensions of the cooling tower units, the turbine hall and the boiler house in your reference document 10.6, which we received in December 2014, the applicant stated that only the maximum width, as stated in the as-submitted DCO, needed to be changed and that the maximum height and lengths would remain the same. Further, that the building's overall sizes would not change from the areas and volumes stated in the as-submitted DCO. Can the applicant provide revised drafting to 4.3 to ensure that none of the maximum values for height, width and length can be exceeded should a development order be granted?
From the applicant's point of view, this question seems to be mixing two distinct elements. I'll seek to clarify what those are. The December document you mentioned, reference 10.6, sought to explain that the maximum permitted widths of the cooling tower and the turbine hall needed to be extended. And that was to accommodate a revised layout, which the applicant considered may be necessary to respect the protective envelope around the AFAN trunk sewer that runs through the site. The document explained that the maximum permitted width of the turbine hall would need to be increased from 65 to 85 metres, and the width of the cooling tower from 16 to 25 metres. Those maximum widths were subsequently included in the revision 1 of the draft DCO that was submitted in February. As the December document made clear, those extended widths were not intended to facilitate an overall increase in the size of those buildings. It was intended to enable a revised layout so that those buildings would essentially be wider but shorter in length. Mm-hmm. So any increase in the width would be accommodated by coincide with a reduction in the length of the buildings. And to ensure that was the case, we added an additional parameter for those and other buildings, which specified maximum areas or footprint and volumes. And those volumes were consistent with the original DCO that was submitted and the basis on which the environmental statement had been carried out. Requirement 4.3 refers to those maximum parameters, but provides a limited degree of flexibility for the local authority to approve minor or immaterial increases to those the dimensions of the turbine hall and the boiler house only. So not the cooling tower, as was mentioned in the December document. It's just the turbine hall and the boiler house. The rationale for that was explained in our response to the first written question number 3.01, and subsequently in response to the Rule 17 request issued on the 30th of January. And in essence, it was to provide flexibility having regard to the way these projects are procured and the fact that at this stage there is no detailed design, and it was to allow for the possibility that when that detailed design comes forward, should there be a small, or, and the flexibility is qualified to minor or immaterial amendments, those would be permitted, provided that the local authority was satisfied that they didn't give rise to minor, or wouldn't give rise to any different or new environmental effects from those that were set out in the ES, and also that it wouldn't result in an overall increase in the size of the building from the maximum envelope set out in the original draft of the DCO. So on that basis, the requirement 4.3 as drafted doesn't, it does provide for the maximum width of those buildings to be increased within those strictly defined circumstances set out in 4.3. Now, in response to the question and the request for revised drafting, the applicant for deadline 6 will submit the alternative drafting, which we would consider would be required if ultimately the examining authority and subsequently the Secretary of State didn't accept the approach that's currently adopted in the draft DCO, which gives that small amount of flexibility in relation to the turbine hall or boiler house. So we will submit that drafting as an alternative, but we remain of the view at this stage that requirement 4.3 is consistent with the overall approach recommended in particular in advice note 15, in that it sets maximum parameters which cannot be exceeded in terms of the overall area and volume of those buildings.
Thank you for that explanation. I look forward to receiving the revised drafting you mentioned by deadline 6. I should just say at this stage, I remain a little uncomfortable about the need to remain to sustain that flexibility in the light of the principles of One the Rochdale envelope, whereby the max dim should be agreed as the maximum beyond which the development will not grow, and such, if there was a need to change that somewhat, then change it and fix it again, so the Secretary of State can then be confident that the envelope will not be exceeded in any way. And secondly, if you're only asking for the flexibility to enable minor or immaterial changes to be allowed following detailed design, what sort of order would those minor or immaterial changes in dimensions be?
I think the maximum parameters we've set were based on the information available at the time, and which we considered were realistic based on the absence of a detailed design, and we used for the purpose of the assessment and. The increase in width that was set out in December involved, if you like, sensitivity testing against the assessment that had been carried out. And I think the applicant's view is that they don't want, or they're not in a position at this stage to set any wider parameters within the scope of what's been assessed. And the mechanism under requirement 4.3 that would allow for minor or immaterial increases to be approved, it would ultimately be for the local planning authority to be satisfied that that didn't give rise to any, or that those were still within the scope of what had been assessed. So I'm not able to give a figure for what order of increase that would be. It would be on a case-by-case basis, and the local authority would have to be satisfied that it didn't give rise to different effects, and if it did, they wouldn't approve the increases.
Thank you for that. I look forward to the drafting. Neith Talbot, want to say anything?
No, we're okay, thank you.
Thank you. The second issue here regarding the minor revisions to the wording relating to the current practice in Wales, as put forward by Neithport Talbot.
The applicant will confirm the position at deadline 6 on that. On the face of it, it doesn't appear that that change in drafting has any substantive effect, and provisionally happy to say that the applicant would accept that. Of course, that is in the context of the requirement 4.3 mechanism that which I just described.
Indeed.
is in question.
Indeed. Yeah. Thank you. Moving on to 4.4.3 Schedule 2 Requirement 21, safety. Can the applicant confirm that their safety assessment report, as discussed at the DCO hearing on the 12th of February, will be submitted to the EXA by deadline 6?
Yes, sir, I can confirm that it will be submitted by deadline 6.
Thank you. We move now on to 4.4.4, Schedule 4, Protected Provisions, Part 1. And we need to work through those various interested parties. If we could start with Netrail.
The protected provisions that are currently in the draft DCO, Revision 2, are agreed with Network Rail. Network Rail solicitors have confirmed this to the examining authority in their letter of the 19th of March, which was submitted to the examining authority. I think that was deadline 5. That letter does confirm that the drafting of those provisions is agreed, but it still remains for agreements to be put in place in relation to the grant of the necessary rights.
Thank you. Western Power?
Western Power have confirmed that, have agreed a set of protected provisions, which we will submit to the examining authority by deadline 6. Western Power have indicated that the agreement to those provisions is subject to any additional impacts being identified in the remainder of the examination. Mm-hmm. And if any additional impacts on their apparatus were to be identified, they would want to review their position. But subject to that, the draft we submit next week is agreed between the parties.
Thank you. National Grid Electricity?
They protective provisions with National Grid are close to being agreed. They are currently with National Grid awaiting their final comments. We'll update you next week, sir.
Thank you. Dŵr Cymru?
Yes, sir. The protective provisions are agreed, and we will submit evidence, written evidence from Welsh Water, confirming that for deadline 6.
Thank you. I should have recorded while we were discussing the PPs with National Grid Electricity that the email received on the 14th recorded that they were, quote, close to finalising satisfactory terms with the applicant, and as a consequence, they were not planning to attend this hearing. Thank you for your comments on Dŵr Cymru. Let's move on then to Associated British Ports, please.
There isn't, as yet, an agreement on the draft protective provisions. You have in front of you the draft that was submitted by ABP, I think deadline 4, possibly mm-hmm. 5, I think it was deadline 4. The applicant has submitted a revised draft to ABP in response to those with revisions, and ABP have indicated that the revisions aren't agreed, but I haven't yet had a formal response from ABP, and the reason for that is ABP have indicated that they would like further discussions directly between ABP and Tata. Now, those I know ABP has made efforts to make contact with people at Tata and but unfortunately that the outcome of that is that only this morning has a discussion been held, which I wasn't party to. So I'm not able to give you a lot more information about that, sir. There remain differences between the parties. From the applicant's point of view, we remain hopeful that these can be resolved as soon as possible, and we'll arrange the necessary meetings to take the issues forward. If, in the event that they can't be, we will submit the applicant's preferred protective provisions to the examining authority so that you have those in front of you. The essential difference from the approach taken by the applicant and ABP is that the draft protective provisions submitted by ABP imposed abstraction limits in relation to the different sources of abstraction. The applicant doesn't consider that those abstraction limits achieve the objectives or at least address the concerns that were specifically raised by ABP in their written representations, which were principally about water levels during periods of low flow, dry weather conditions. The applicant's preferred approach is to have specified levels with water levels within the dock and to set out measures that must be taken by the applicant if those levels are threatened, principally impounding water, which is what would be done under such circumstances at the moment. That's the approach that the applicant has adopted in its protective provisions and that it submitted to ABP, and ABP has indicated that those aren't satisfactory. So the dialogue will continue, and I hope I'll be able to provide you with a clearer update next week, sir.
Thank you. We will be discussing that under a further agenda item. So perhaps we'll hold your comments from there, unless you'd like to say anything at the moment.
No, ADP? Sir, I'm happy to come back when we get to 2.5.3, although there are some comments I'd like to make, but obviously we have some oral written submissions and others to make later, so I'll deal with it then.
Thank you. Moving on then to 449 Schedule 5, I believe we've discussed this, so the oral record will show the discussion, and I propose that we await information to be submitted at deadline 6, unless anybody wants to say anything. Nope. Thank you. Next, 4.5 Environmental then. The situation regarding the environmental permit. Can the applicant provide a progress update on the status of the EP application, please, and provide the latest details of when this may be concluded in agreement with NRW?
Sir, I'll ask Catherine Anderson of AECOM to update you on this.
Fine, thank you.
Afternoon, sir. Apologies for my voice. Just to give you an update on the environmental permit variation application, a meeting was held with NRW on the 18th of March. We intend, with NRW's permission, to submit those minutes to this deadline 6 to show the progress on the application for the variation. We have a couple of things awaiting NRW in relation to air quality and the HRA that was submitted as part of the DCO application. As it stands, the meeting and the actions have all been agreed. Progress is ongoing, and based on current timescales, it is the intention to submit the variation application before deadline 7 of May the 11th.
Thank you for that. That's encouraging. NRW, do you wish to comment?
The meeting to which Catherine referred was actually the second meeting that they had with ourselves. As far as we're concerned, pre-application discussions are progressing normally. Okay.
Thank you. Moving on then to the situation regarding the update on the outcome of the final site investigation report that was due to be available late March or early April. I should apologise for the typo in my second questions, which suggested it would be available sometime between late March and early June. I did mean, of course, to say late March and early April. Could you please, applicant, provide us an update on the items as listed?
Catherine will speak again about this.
Thank you.
Yes, all site investigation works have now been completed. The final report was submitted to NRW and Neath Patalba on the 7th of April. The meeting has been now agreed for the 27th of April to discuss the findings of that and also of the DQRA, which is due to be submitted prior to that meeting as well. Subject to the discussions of that meeting, that will inform then the remedial option strategy, which will then be submitted for comment to all parties by the 11th of May. In relation to the coal authority, they again have also been provided with the final report. That was on the 13th of April, as well as information in relation to the coal reserves. I do have quite an extensive summary of the site investigation, which I can either summarise now or provide as part of the response to the question as part of deadline six.
A brief summary, I think, would be helpful, okay. Catherine, if your voice can manage it.
Yeah. As previously advised in the last hearings, the initial site investigation identified hydrocarbon impacted on site in several hotspots. Further site investigation and groundwater monitoring has identified that the site is impacted in the groundwater. Both elevated chemical analysis results and free phase has been observed on site and through the actual groundwater monitoring itself. In terms of remedial options, we are looking at a range of those which will be confirmed through the DQRA. We are looking at on-site options. There is still not the possibility of taking material off-site, although, again, that will be confirmed through the remedial options as we go forward.
Okay, thank you. That covers that part of the listing. Could I just ask you to bring me up to date in relation to how the results to date are impacting on the agreement of a piling method statement in terms of noise and vibration?
That will be informed through the remedial options.
Okay. So the remedial options which will be submitted after these discussions?
Yes, yeah.
Deadline 7.
Yeah. Again, that piling method will have due regard to other elements such as proximity to dwellings and also the type of piling that will be required for certain other buildings on site, not just the power station, but the associated buildings as well, and proximity to the trunk main.
Does either Neathport Tolbert or NRW wish to say anything at this stage? I'm just concerned that there was quite a lot hanging on the results of this final SI report in regards to noise, vibration, contaminated land, traffic movements, etc. So I hope that the discussions at the meetings to enable the conclusions to be addressed in the remedial options will address all those satisfactorily. Thank you for that. So now we shall move to 4.5.3, the water abstraction hierarchy, and I'd ask Associated Reports, please, if you could provide me with some more information, ideally graphically. But I looked at the information you provided following our last hearing, and I have to say I was a little confused, and perhaps you could explain for my benefit and perhaps others. It would appear from my limited investigation into the levels you provided was that the levels set red and amber by the applicant are very similar to, if not the same, as those levels required for the smaller vessels of 3,000 tonnes to have their underkill clearance for access to the inner dock. And that being the case, and also the comments you made in the submission you provided as a written representation of the oral submission at the previous hearing indicated that problems were overcome through the fortuitous arrival of spring tides, which I found interesting, in as much as spring tides don't arrive fortuitously, they arrive on a tidal cycle characteristic to the port in question. I just wonder, we've discussed this a bit so far today, and that there's an issue regarding whether it should be driven by abstraction quantities, which it seems to me the way ABP would like to drive it, or through the protection of actual water levels in the inner dock. which to me at this stage seems a more practicable way of driving it. Perhaps you could comment on those issues for me.
Yes, sir, thank you. And perhaps I could take a step back then, moving back to the initial discussion on protective provisions. Your question is quite technical, obviously, sir, and we will provide written, graphical, detailed evidence for you for the deadline. But Mr. Slorak is here to expand, should it be so required. But as far as the protective provision and, as you put it, sir, AVP's requirements, which are, I would suggest, a little more than just requirements, at the risk of being repetitively boring, AVP fully supports the project, the Tata Steel project. There's no question of that, and we are working with Tata Steel and want to see their project successfully consented. Our difficulty, sir, is that as a competent statutory harbour authority, which is entirely separate from us being the operator and owner of the port, we have certain statutory obligations. And without appearing to be overly legal, there is an 1847 Act, Section 33 of which, and I'll give you the details in writing for the next deadline, sir, which provide that we are statutory required to maintain an open port. Historically, sir, I was informed by one of my colleagues over lunch that, in fact, this was because in the old days, owners and operators of the port used to try and keep their competitors out of the port. And so in 1847, it was decreed that ports should be open ports. Now, to be an open port at Port Talbot, we advertise a 7.7-metre level of water above the sill being where the lock is. So we are statutory obliged. If a ship owned by Mr. Bloggs comes along and he wants to get in, he's got 7.7 draft, then we must be able to accommodate that vessel. A 7.7 draft looks to a underkeel clearance of 1.1, 1.2 metres. So we are looking to maintain throughout 8.6, 8.8 level in the dock. And that is advertised as such, and that's our obligation. And that's a statutory obligation falling upon ABP, regardless of its ownership of the port. And, sir, the only difficulty we have with regard to agreeing a protective provision with Tata, the applicant, is that we must have control ourselves and total discretion as to how the water is kept at the appropriate levels. Tata have certain difficulties in their worried about the salinity levels that come into the dock as far as abstraction to the power project. And ABP fully understand that. That is a position that ABP work with Tata Steel already with regard to. But the position as far as the protective provision is concerned is that ABP has no choice. It's not a question of negotiating with Tata. It has no flexibility. It must be able to control the water levels within the dock, both for Tata's use and indeed for other customers. Now, sir, that is my layman's interpretation. Mr. Slorak can today give you more detailed information, should you so require, but he has promised to give me lots of graphical details, which I will pass to you in due course. Mr. Cooper here can talk about the actual operational needs of vessels when they come into the dock, if that would assist them.
I look forward to receiving the evidence from your colleagues, and that would be most helpful, because when I tried to investigate this recently, the link between chart and ordnance datum suggested that you weren't able to accommodate any ships during the NEAP tidal cycle. By the level relation you gave between chart and ordnance and the published sill level on your website, which is why I've asked for the graphical information so that can be clarified.
Yes, sir. Would you like Mr. Slorak to endeavour to answer that question now, or would you like us to put it in writing?
I think it would, because the detail is important. I would welcome any comment Mr. Clorock would like to make, but obviously I would like to see it supported by the written evidence in due course. Would you like to?
Sorry, we could certainly supply written evidence. Do I understand your question is about access outside the port that is restricted by neap tides, or are you talking about access within the port in times when neap tides are happening in the sea outside?
I'm interested in the effect on port operations in the inner harbour, which is the one that's going to be impacted, I understand, by potential abstraction by the applicant during periods of low flow in the rivers that feed that area.
Okay. I'll try and answer your question, sir. It's normally the practice to keep dock water levels at a level that's slightly above the levels of spring tides. And that's for various operational reasons. Part of it is because the lock gates that we operate with in South Wales are mitre-type lock gates. And if there are storms with swells that come along on a high tide, there's danger of the gates slamming when surges occur in the channel outside the dock. And therefore, it's quite normal to keep dock water levels at a highish level anyway. And that also gives us a reserve of water for consumption by locking. Some of the ports in South Wales have the advantage of feeders, other ones don't, and they are maintained entirely by either impounding or by no impounding in the case of one of the South Wales ports. The normal operating procedures for a dock would be to maintain a high water level in the dock, which was able to accommodate ships at the advertised acceptance criteria. And as one can see from the published information from AVP, that relates to a ship of draft 7.7 metres. And therefore, the required water level is between 8.6 and 8.8 metres over the sill.
For the larger vessels?
For the larger vessels.
Reducing to 7.8 or 7.6 for the majority of vessels you currently attract to the inner harbour, being the 3,000-ton vessels.
Yes, the intention is that the port will be used to its full capacity in the future regarding water depths.
Thank you for that. I look forward to the evidence you will submit in due course, because I need to be very clear on this in order that we can I can make a decision, a recommendation based on the evidence. And I hope that discussions will continue between the parties. I don't know whether the applicant wishes to say anything further at this juncture.
Only so that you know, Mr. Greenwood's statement was that ABP must be able to control water levels within the dock. The protective provisions that Tata are proposing, and I appreciate you don't have those in front of you, set specified levels and say that Tata must impound, must do things to ensure those levels are maintained. Now, it may well be that ABP don't agree with the water levels that set out in that draft, and if so, that it would be helpful to know what they consider the level should be. But we don't consider that the abstraction limits set out in ABP's draft protective provisions, which were submitted to the examining authority, enable them to control water levels within the dock. And that's why we haven't just accepted those provisions. But we absolutely will continue to discuss these points and seek to resolve them.
Thank you, both parties, for that. I look forward to further updates, hopefully by deadline 6. Thank you. Moving on to 454 then, that just to close out an issue regarding compliance with the Water Framework Directive, could I ask NRW to confirm whether they are satisfied that the development proposal will not lead to any adverse effects on the achievement of the environmental objectives established under the WFD, REF MPSEN Para 515.5? NRW?
Yes, sir. Can I just say at this stage that WFD has been considered and we will be submitting written reps stating that, but obviously expanding on that issue. But yes, it's definitely been considered and we are satisfied that the proposal will not lead to an adverse effect on, not an adverse effect, yes, adverse effect on the environmental objectives of WFD.
Thank you for that. Moving on then to agenda item 5, any other relevant business? Does any party have any other business they feel should have been addressed at this issue-specific hearing? Applicant?
It wasn't any other business, sir. It was just to acknowledge the inconvenience that was caused by our lack of notice for the previous hearings, including the issue-specific hearing, and we appreciate the way that the examining authority have responded constructively to that omission, and also to thank the other interested parties for their ongoing cooperation and their attendance today, and we appreciate the inconvenience that was caused by that.
Thank you, applicant, for that, and thank you all other parties for your time and input as well. So, with there being no other relevant business to discuss, I shall move on to the closing remarks. May I remind you that a recording of this hearing will be placed on the Port Talbot pages of the National Infrastructure section of the Planning Portal, and that you are required to provide written summaries of all representations made at this hearing on or before deadline 6 next Thursday, the 23rd of April. These should include as appendices any material mentioned and or committed to at this hearing. So if there are no other relevant points that any party wishes to make, then I formally close this second issue-specific hearing and thank you very much for your attendance and your input. Good afternoon.